Welcome to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to the Shift Extension Paramedic Podcast. I'm Nick. Sunny's back. It's 2024. It's our second episode of the year, and we have a very special guest. Sunny, happy new year, mate. How are you?
Happy New Year. Look, I sound a darn sight better than you. You're sounding a little bit raspy there. What's going on?
Mate, it's just part of the festive season. Just picked up a little virus somewhere and it's just lingering, but that's okay. We'll persist.
Nick, I'm really excited about this one. We've got a guest. So I do a terrible job of introducing guests, so I normally turn it over to them. But we have Jordan Emery, who is the head of Ambulance Tasmania and has been for a while now. But Jordan, how are you?
Yeah, good, Sunny. Good, Nick. Thanks so much for having me on.
No, thank you very much for joining us today. We know that you're probably an incredibly busy man. Jordan, before we get started, there's something that has just been burning in the back of Nick and my mind since we first started speaking about recording this podcast, and that is Craig Emery. Jordan Emery. Please tell us, is there any relation or is this just coincidence?
No, it's coincidence. Hey, like Emery's it's not a particularly common surname. I don't know that I've met a lot of other Emerys, and it's kind of bizarre that he leads Queensland Ambulance Service and I lead Ambulance Tasmania, but no, we have no relation whatsoever.
That is unbelievable, and I now owe Nick $5. Jordan, I mean, you're the absolute top of your industry now. You're leading an ambulance service. Mate, where did you begin?
Yeah, look, I began as a uni student, really, at Charles Sturt University in Bathurst. So when I finished high school, I was really keen to become a paramedic. I went and studied paramedicine at university and then started working as a paramedic in Sydney with New South Wales Ambulance.
And that was, this is a long time ago. Sorry if that offends you, but that was a long time ago, Jordan. I'm curious to know what it was like as a uni student back then, because a lot of services were still very heavily diploma staff.
Yeah.
So you would have been a rarity back then.
Yeah. New South Wales AMBOs was sort of on a journey around university graduates. Interestingly, I did my first 2 years of uni and then did my clinical placement period at the end of my second year, which was the structure of the program at that time. And then I thought, shit, you know, I've learned more in this 4 weeks of placement than I've learned in the last 2 years of university. Now, clearly that wasn't the case, but it's certainly how I felt at the time. And so I applied for the general entry pathway and was accepted into the general entry or diploma pathway. And so in my first year of working for New South Wales Ambulance, I finished my bachelor's degree and then went through like an RPL process. So I'm kind of this weird hybrid of a university graduate who came into New South Wales AMBOs through the general pathway because I hadn't quite finished my degree when they first offered me a job.
Yeah, wow. So you started on road in 2008 with New South Wales Ambulance?
Yeah, correct.
And 15 years on road with them before you went into a management stream?
No. I started moving into leadership roles around sort of 2000 probably 10, 11, 12 sort of thing. You know, initially in that, I did my intensive care training and then went into sort of frontline leadership roles, a station officer or team leader type roles, and then moved into a duty operations manager, which is, I guess, like I'm trying to think of the different jurisdictional comparisons, but I guess it's like a senior operations supervisor in QAS, for example. And then moved into more senior leadership roles as a zone manager and associate director of operations. Yeah.
You also took a bit of a break from ambulance, if we have snooped you appropriately. You had a two or three year working for a private company. What was that?
Yeah. In 2016, I had been working as the executive staff officer to the commissioner of New South Wales Ambulance. And I decided to take a 2 year career break and I moved to New York. And I worked for a global mental health NGO or not-for-profit called Strong Minds, and we were delivering community mental health programs to women in East Africa, predominantly in Uganda, but also towards the end of my time with them in Zambia as well.
Wow.
That's a big change up. I mean, one, you've left the career that you've known, you know, since you left high school, and two, you've left the country you've grown up in.
Yeah.
I mean, to then come back a few years later, back into the original ambulance service that you were working for. How does that happen?
Well, a couple of things. So one, I was chasing love. That's why I moved to New York. But I'd also finished my master's of public health, and so I was like really keen to push myself into a broader, health discipline and beyond just the kind of walls of paramedicine as a profession. But also, I should say, New South Wales AMBOS at the time very graciously gave me 2 years leave without pay. And the visa that I was granted by the US government was a 2-year visa. So there was kind of this natural alignment and opportunity to move over to New York, live in Manhattan, work for this NGO, travel a bit between Africa and New York, and then come back to my substantive position with New South Wales AMBOS at the end of the 2 years. So it was all pretty nicely packaged up.
Pretty ordained. If I'm prying, you can let me know. How did the love go? Did they come back with you?
He did, but sometime later we separated, but I have no regrets about that. He's a bloody good person, and it's been a great personal journey for me, so I could never complain.
How was going from working from a state ambulance service in Australia to a NGO in another country? How was the mindset different or the same from a leadership perspective, and the teams you worked with, and what lessons did you take out of ambulance that helped you or hindered you when you went over there and when you came back?
Yeah, it's a great question, Nick, because I think one of the things that I had become so accustomed to that I probably didn't even realize is that working in government is very process driven. You know, there are a range of sort of procedures and processes and steps that everything must go through, and clearly defined approval processes. You know, everyone would relate to this. And when you're working in the not-for-profit sector, or at least in this small not-for-profit I was working for, it essentially is you determine the destiny of the organization. You know, you and yes, there are approvals and governance, but it's a much smaller, leaner fit out. And Sean, who was the founder of the NGO and my boss, who was an incredible and inspiring guy, he had come from a business background and, you know, had worked in public health but wasn't a clinician, and had worked in government in diplomatic roles, but then had gone on to sort of do his MBA and work in the tech industry. So he had this mindset of, you know, failing forward, being disruptive, you know, being scalable in everything we did, and chasing down sort of maximum impact, you know. So you can imagine that working for Strong Minds, this NGO, we were all about how many women can we get into our program and deliver mental health services. We wanted more patients, more demand, more people using our services. And I'm not sure that there's any ambulance service in the country that's saying we want more patients, more demand, more people utilizing our services. So it's this kind of, it was a quantum shift in thinking, really.
Do you think that these policies and procedures blunt creativity in government? Or do you think that we're just a bit defensive of what we have and we don't want to change it up too much and move too far away from what we know works?
It's not a leading question Nick's just thrown to you either.
it's a great question, because it's caused by this incredible tension, right? And that tension is that governments as organized systems funded by you and me and the taxpayer, there is an expectation from the public, and rightly so, that we are scrutinized and very considered about how we go about our business, and importantly, how we use public money. So if I think about Ambulance Tasmania, right, every year the state entrusts in me $150 million of their money to administer this service. And if I had $150 million, there isn't a lot of people in my life that I would entrust to spend that money on my behalf. right? That would do so in a way that I thought was really responsible and in my best interest. So there was kind of this like sacred trust from the public that we spend their money carefully. I think one of the challenges around that, Nick, is that we can create systems and processes and bureaucracy around that to do it in such a way that can then really get in the way of the effective delivery of our services from time to time. It's not unique to Tassie. It's not unique to ambulance services. I think it's just one of the difficult tensions between administering public services and meeting the expectations of the public, and then also working in an environment where, you know, agility and technological advancement and all of those things are kind of pulling us in lots of different directions. How was that? That was like a pretty...
I love it.
It's like a pretty...
It is.
It's a pretty
it is.
Bureaucratic answer. Thanks for indulging me.
It's interesting hearing it too, because Nick and I have both worked in several different government roles like you, and we've also both worked in the private sector. There certainly seems to be an institutional approach in government.
Yeah.
Which it can be interpreted as stifling innovation and creativity. I mean, look, one of the portfolios I held several years ago was the manager of governance and innovation. And it used to amuse me because they're two conflicting ideologies. Certainly the governance side of that was 99%. The innovation was 1%. Because the processes that had been put in place, I guess, were safe.
Yeah.
And people certainly were scared to step outside of those. But one of the experiences in my career, though, and this is, you know, when I'm talking to new paramedics who've been out on the street for 1, 2, or 3 years and they're getting comfortable in the role, is, you know, I say to them, you've got to get uncomfortable. You've got to step outside of this comfortable role you're in now, because I'm sure that stepping laterally, stepping up and stepping down, stepping from government to the private sector and back again, and vice versa, has only, it's influenced and it certainly changed and improved the way that I look at things or the way that I approach things. And, you know, when we were first talking about getting you on for a chat, it's because you're doing things differently, Jordan. And it's, you know, hearing about this experience you've got in the private sector where you can basically shape the organization and move forwards as you, you know, you need to grow it versus you need to be accountable for the organization and what you're doing. It certainly creates a challenging environment for people to innovate in ambulances and in government.
Yeah.
But it's not something that we should fear, and it's certainly not something that we shouldn't encourage. Why? I mean, do you think that it is because of the need to be accountable that things like innovation and development in that respect are challenged or are, you know, I don't want to use the word discouraged, Jordan, but certainly some of my experiences, they have been very much discouraged.
Yeah. I think one of the challenges, mate, is that we're all working in resource-constrained settings. You know, the cost of delivering healthcare services is going up and up, and we're struggling to do that within our budgets. And that's not just ambulance services. I mean, I think broadly governments are struggling to deliver health services within the budgets that they have available to them. And so I think at times innovation can be seen as a bit of a luxury. Now, clearly that's not the case, but it can be seen as a sort of second order issue that has to sit behind service delivery. And all of us would know these sort of terms of phrase that you hear, you know, subject to operational demand was one of those terms that, you know, when I was a paramedic working on road, it always felt like that caveat meant it'll never happen because operational demand will always trump everything else. And I do think that speaks to sort of one of the broader challenges of trying to deliver services in resource-constrained settings where demand for ambulance is only on the up and up. You know, trying to do that within the funding envelope or within the resourcing envelope that we currently have is pretty challenging. But that said, we also know that our way out of some of this pain is really through innovation. And so I think we have to shift both our risk appetite and our willingness to no longer accept the status quo and embark on new innovative technologies and approaches to delivering care. So, and we're doing some of that in Tassie, and we're following the lead of some other ambulance services, and we're trying to embark on some of that ourselves too.
I wouldn't want to say it's a blessing in disguise, but do you think because we are in a situation now where we have tightening budgets and increasing operational demand and aging population and big population growth, that now is the time for innovation?
Yeah, yeah. And just to reset the way we do things. I mean, I think that there are some really exciting and kind of a little unsettling frontiers ahead of us in terms of that innovation space that might really change the way we deliver ambulance services into the future. And if I even think about emergency call taking, you know, I've heard some technologists talk about how that could largely be done using artificial intelligence. Now, I'm not foreshadowing the removal of emergency call takers, and I'm not saying that there would be no need for human beings in those roles. Of course, that's not the case. I guess what I'm saying is we might see some quantum shifts in the way we deliver ambulance services in a way that we are not even currently imagining. And I also think that, you know, sometimes because we're on these big aircraft carriers, you know, and I'm referring to our organizations that are moving very slowly across enormous expanses of water, to carry the analogy forward, it doesn't feel very noticeable that changes and substantial changes are happening. And then I think if you said to a paramedic or indeed an ambulance officer back in 1970 that in the future we will arrive, we will apply a 12 lead ECG machine, we will do an ECG, we will transmit that to a cardiologist via Bluetooth, we will liaise with that cardiologist via a mobile phone and then commence pre-hospital thrombolysis of that patient. We'll bypass the nearest hospital and take them to a cardiac catheterization lab where they will have a stent put in and return to work 3 or 4 days later. Like, that's a pretty massive change in a relatively short period of time. But because we're sort of living it, it doesn't always feel like innovation is really happening. And I think that's one of the things we have to buffer against our own sort of biases around that.
I think I heard what he said, Nick. The CEO, Jordan Emery, just said that we're all going to be out of jobs because of AI. Like, ambulances are going to drive themselves. And yeah, okay, all right, we're on.
That's right, yeah. Yeah.
We'll have Tesla ambulances in no time.
I'll be out of a job too.
But like you said, though, I mean, it's things that we're probably not even considering at this point is what's going to be happening in 5 years' time. Change, you know, it takes small changes to make small changes, which are, you know, end up being really big changes.
Something
you referenced before, Jordan, is you said we need to, I guess, get comfortable increasing our risk appetite to innovate and change things. And, I mean, one of the things, that we've discussed in the past has been, the discouragement of these, you know, these innovative approaches and things like that. Mm. You took a huge risk. Last year, you jumped up in front of a bunch of your peers, the leaders in paramedicine in Australia, and you spoke about leading in a completely different kind of, I guess, culture or a different approach. I'm still yet to watch the full lecture. I apologize. So now I'm speaking well out of turn, but I've heard people speak about you talking about leading with love, leading with kindness. Now, if we match what a leader does and what a manager does, the two very different things that kind of go hand in hand. And sometimes we've got to, you know, move in between them. Mm. But can you unpack this approach that you discussed last year around this, you know, what's missing?
Yeah, it's thanks for the question. It didn't feel super courageous, to be honest. But I appreciate you saying that. For me, it's really about how we can embed heart-centered leadership into our way of leading people.
Hold on, Jordan. Sorry. I'm going to put my hand up here. I need to speak. Is your off stretcher button pushed?
Right. Which are all reasonable questions to ask.
Have you had 3 minutes of a meal break? Good, because we're talking about heart-centered leadership. This is different to what most of the operations managers we've seen out there are doing.
Yeah. And look, you know, I guess in a way, Sani, I enjoy sort of a position of privilege, right? Because I'm the chief executive of Ambulance Tasmania, so I get to sort of sit back and sort of set the tone of the organization broadly, without necessarily having to address things like off stretcher and meal break and allocating a resource for the next job and all of those sorts of things.
Leading and managing. You are correct.
I enjoy a level of privilege in that respect. But I also have been that operational leader. You know, I've been a duty operations manager where I've had to speak with crews about absenteeism, where I've had to speak with people about, you know, why, you know, the standards of their patient care records were poor or not to the required quality, or why they were, you know, sitting as still loaded at hospital when they'd been offloaded half an hour earlier. And for me, I tried to always do that from a loving place where my focus was on helping our people and our organization achieve its fullest potential.
Isn't that's interesting even to hear you say that, because there are, you know, a lot of minds out there that will be saying, well, I'm the manager, I've got to manage this. And I think, you know, I've been on both ends of those myself, Jordan, where I've had to manage these things. And I've also been managed with these things before. And, you know, reflecting on those experiences, when I was being managed, so often it felt like I was being downspoken to. It wasn't a safe place. It wasn't a comfortable place. It wasn't an encouraging place. And so as I moved through my own career path, I tried to keep those experiences, I guess, at the forefront of my mind, because, I mean, like everyone, hopefully, I have had a couple really, really good mentors in my life. You know, I could probably count the good mentors I've had on one hand, which some people would say is sad, but I actually think that's a really good place to be, because these are the people who I'd spend probably the least amount of time with who had the most impact. And certainly the theme from these people was not clinical brilliance. It was humanity. It was being a human and treating people like a human. You know, I learned that you could still manage people while still supporting them. And one of the guys had said to me years ago, you can either work with me or you can work for me, and it's going to be your choice. I'm happy to work with you, but this is what I need done. And it was a really encouraging place to find myself, because this is someone that's going to put me on an even pedestal, even though there's a hierarchical difference, and say, well, let's work together on this. And it meant that I did have to improve some things, but it was just a different approach to anything that I had experienced in the past. When you talk about heart-centered leadership, you know, we talk about the difference between leading and managing. I'm a full believer that you can, you can do that.
Yeah, and frankly, I mean, I would go a step further and say it's not even that you can; it's that you must. You must lead in that way. In order to achieve, well, in order for our people and our organizations to achieve their fullest potential. And I come back to this quote that I talk about in the presentation by a remarkable leader, Daymanu Shafiq, who she is the director of the London School of Economics, you know, one of the best business and political schools in the world. And she says, in the past, jobs were about muscles. Now they're about brains, and in the future they'll be about heart. And what she means by that is, you know, in many years gone by, you know, strength, might, muscle were important to succeed in a very sort of manual, labor-intensive workforce. But we've seen this big sort of technological change and a rapid pace of change that has demanded intellect in the knowledge economy. What really has differentiated people is that they're smart, they're intelligent, they've got the brains to cut through in a knowledge economy. But what we know is that as generative artificial intelligence and other technologies rapidly supersede even the most advanced human intelligence, it's clear that's what will really differentiate the leaders of the future is their ability to lead not with strength or intelligence, but to lead with love, with deep emotion, with connection, vulnerability, authenticity, a capacity to really connect with the incredible people that make up our organizations and drive high-performing cultures and teams through heart-centered leadership, not through intelligence, not through strength and might, not through command and control or power over, but through inspiring, empowering, heart-centered leadership.
In the past, it was muscle.
Yeah.
In the
now it's about brains.
Now it's about brains.
It'll be about heart.
And then in the future, it's about AI with no heart. No, I'm joking.
Yeah. Well, it's just clear that AI and other technologies are replacing a lot of the intellectual needs of the workforce. I'm not saying you don't need to be intelligent anymore. I guess I'm just saying, you know, a lot of, you know, I don't know about you, but since calculators have become commonplace, my maths is shit house, right? So if you extrapolate that idea more broadly, you start to realize that, you know, what will differentiate great workplaces, great teams in the future won't be about how intelligent everyone is. It'll be about how they lead with heart-centered leadership. And so if I can provide you another great example, in the sort of 2010, 11, 12 period, Google as a company really wanted to understand what drove team effectiveness in their organizations. And they embarked on this massive study called Project Aristotle, you know, relying on the quote by Aristotle that we're the sum of all parts. And they said, you know, that they had this belief or this assumption that what was going to make a great organization, what makes a great team, is that they have the smartest Ivy League graduates from, you know, Stanford, from Harvard, from Yale, from Caltech and MIT, all the best schools. And if they brought all of those people together, they would have these really great high-performing teams. And in fact, what they realized was that that wasn't the case at all. And the single biggest contributor to team effectiveness was psychological safety, the capacity for members within a team to take interpersonal risks, to share mistakes, shortcomings, failures, to challenge the status quo without the fear of being shamed or humiliated. And when that psychological safety existed within the team, that's when the teams thrived. And that's heart-centered leadership to the team.
Jordan, do you think, like traditionally, and I think I reflect back on my career with an ambulance per se, and there seems to be, and even today, there seems to be this underlying fog of, you know, us versus them, of, you know, the on-road operational paramedics versus management, and people have this unfounded, and it is unfounded, perception that they're out to get us, or they're going to bring the hammer down on us, or I'm going to lose my job, or I'm going to get deregistered, or, you know, that the organization isn't there to support you to do what you need to do for the community, for your clients per se. That they're there to be punitive. And I get it that there is times where punitive action needs to occur because we need to maintain a standard set by the community.
But how
do we break this down? And do you think by doing so, it'll correlate to better care for our patients? Like if we can feel the love, if the operation staff feel the love in a sense, will they give more love to their patients?
Yeah. Well, I think that's the nuts and bolts of it, right? If you think about all of the relationships you invest in your life, you invest in the ones that are most nourishing and nurturing of you, right? The ones that help you feel valued, respected, loved, safe, cared for are the ones that you invest in, show up authentically, know you can be your true self and want to give to. I don't think our workplace relationships are fundamentally different from that. If we feel loved, supported, cared for, then we're most inclined to put in the effort we can. We're most inclined to do the best job we can. But to the first bit of your question, Nick, you know, in the presentation I gave, I talked first about what I thought were four culture hangups in paramedicine that are really holding our organizations back, and why I thought leading with love or heart-centered leadership was a better alternative. And one of the things that I talk about, or that I talked about and that I believe very strongly through my own observational experience, is this concept of common enemy intimacy. And we create these bonds of false connection with each other by creating a common enemy, right? So, and often that shows up in what I call these dead-end dichotomies, where we say, you know, us versus management, communications versus on-road, ICPs versus APs, uni grads versus non-uni grads. And the list just goes on and on and on. And we make that part of our bonding really early on in paramedic organizations, at least in my observation. And it's this act of kind of dehumanizing other people or othering, you know, where we say they're not like us and therefore we are in opposition to them. And when you operate like that, it's really easy, I think, to just live in this space of kind of scarcity and threat, and they're against us and we've got to stick together because if we're not sticking together, they're going to come and get us. But you start to realize it's pretty kind of primal, and it doesn't actually allow us to be the best versions of ourselves.
It's tribalism.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I think to pick up another point you made, Nick, there's this, leading with love is not about low standards. In fact, it's the opposite. It's, as Valerius Maximus talked about in ancient Rome, it's high standards and deep devotion. So people achieve their fullest potential. People are the best versions of themselves when there are high standards and a deep devotion to helping them achieve those standards. So I always say to people, yeah, if you do the wrong thing, if you sexually harass another employee, if you do the wrong thing, of course there are consequences. And high psychological safety, heart-centered leadership doesn't throw those concepts out the window. In fact, it specifically calls on all of us to lead with love. But it just means that when people do the wrong thing, or when people's behavior falls short of the expected standards, they're managed in a way that is still dignified, respectful, and loving.
This is, you said before, Jordan, you didn't think it was that courageous to get up and speak about this, but I can only imagine that when you are trying to implement a cultural change such as this, the resistance you will receive, I mean, there would no doubt even be some backlash by people who are, I guess, judging your performance, you know, wanting to call you out on hypocrisies. Yeah. All, I mean, this is not a safe place for you to be in. You said this wasn't courageous. This is a huge change in you know, the paramedic culture within Australia, probably the world, that heart-centered leadership is something that we need more of, because, you know, to cycle back to Nick, you know, if you give more love to the staff, they're going to not just give more love to their patients, they will give more love to the organization, which is exactly what Jordan has been speaking about. You know, they will actually want to be there and want to participate to support the organization. And everything is so numbers focused when it should be, you know, people focused.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, sure, like if we just want to keep doing things the way we've been doing them, fine. But in my opening comments of the presentation, I say that you can barely find an ambulance service across the country that hasn't gone through a scathing cultural review about how people feel and are treated, and that their sense of value in an organization. And if you want to go back to numbers and performance, if you don't think that comes at a profound economic and performance cost to the organization, you're delusional. You know, you're delusional. It has a huge cost, and it's been empirically validated time and time again in industries all across the world. Employees that have low engagement, that feel devalued, that feel disrespected, results in significantly poorer economic outputs for the organization than organizations where employees feel loved, valued, safe, and respected. So if ambulance services want to continue to go down a path of more of the same, then we can only expect a plateauing of or a blunting of the performance that we've seen over years. Or we can shake things up in a big way, you know, radically change the way we lead our organizations and be prepared for an explosion of potential within our awesome workforces, our awesome people.
Adam, at the crux of this, I feel like, you know, we speak about emotional intelligence, yet the way most of, well, I mean, the way everyone is measured in school, in university, and eventually their professional workspace is intelligence. You know, so much of the education is around clinical skills. We don't have enough around the emotional intelligent requirements, the leadership principles. But you can correct me if I'm wrong here. In the most simplistic term, emotional intelligence is knowing what you do well, but also knowing what you don't do well. And to be able to accept what you don't do well, and even the need to communicate that to a team so someone else who may do it well can pick up your slack, puts you in a very, very vulnerable place.
Yeah.
And I think this vulnerability is what actually scares people away from this heart-centered approach, because if you are going to lead with a heart, you need emotional intelligence. You need to accept your own vulnerability and actually communicate that in order for the organization to thrive.
Yeah.
How do we get people to be more accepting of their own vulnerability? Because this is also part of the, you know, tribalistic issues, you know, between APs, ACPs, ICPs.
Yeah.
You know, everyone doesn't want to identify, communicate, or even talk about their vulnerabilities, and it puts up a wall.
Yeah. Yeah, I think, you know, it speaks to that issue of psychological safety in teams, right? If the psychological safety is low, people don't want to, as a team dynamic, I mean, people don't want to put themselves out there, right? They don't want to expose their shortcomings or where they've made a mistake, because they're worried about being shamed and humiliated. And I think one of the tragedies is, mate, that's probably what will happen to them. I mean, I know, and I use this example in the presentation, you know, I started at a station in inner city Sydney where we had patient transport officers on the station, PTOs, in New South Wales Ambos, and the common name for them was potatoes, you know. Now, that might seem sort of light and funny, but it's fundamentally dehumanizing, right? And it says, oh, they're lesser than us, they're subordinate to us, they're not worth the same, you know, they're not worth the same status or standing within our station as everyone else. Now, that's just one example that gets replicated 1,000 times over. And whilst I think managers and leaders should be held to a very high standard, these behaviors happen all across our workforce. They happen at every single level. And pretty quickly, you know, we like people to sort of fit in, or we start kind of kicking them to the curb, and what I describe as shit canning them, you know, dehumanizing them, making them lesser so that we feel better about how we dehumanize them, or we feel like it's more acceptable to dehumanize them. To come back to your question about how we create more space for people to be vulnerable, the responsibility absolutely sits with us as leaders, particularly senior leadership roles, to step bravely into the spotlight and expose ourselves first. Because, as I said earlier, I enjoy this structural power and privilege in my role, And as a consequence of that, in fact, it is incumbent on me, because of that privilege and power that I enjoy, that I should make myself most vulnerable. And so, you know, as an example, in Ambulance Tasmania at the end of last year, and I've just started doing it this year too, I'm a bit behind schedule. I've done I'm doing a 360. I've sought feedback from a whole lot of my direct reports, stakeholders, managers, et cetera. And then, as I did last year, I will share, it's de-identified, obviously, in terms of who the responses are from, but I will share those results with my whole team so that they can understand things I do well based on the 360 feedback, the areas that I need to improve, the way I communicate, the way I could communicate better, you know, and I, like, don't get me wrong, you know, this shit makes me feel uncomfortable, but it is a prerequisite of being in a senior leadership role that you have to be prepared to be scrutinized and to step bravely into the fire and actually hear feedback about how you could be doing things better.
No, you've got this wrong. You're supposed to be perfect. We need to makes no mistakes.
Yeah. It's a really good point you make there, right? Because I often say to people too that we've been ripped off as managers and leaders as well. Like, we've been told that you have to have all the answers, you got to know everything, you don't ever fuck anything up, you've got to know it all, and if you don't, you're useless. And frankly, that's just, it's so rubbish, you know.
That also comes right down to the paramedic and student paramedic level.
Yeah, good leadership requires you to your earlier point, demonstrate emotional intelligence, know what you know what you don't know, and seek the wisdom and input of all of the talented people on our team in the way we make decisions on a day-to-day basis.
Do you think historically we didn't have a tolerance of error and mistakes because we work in a field where there's a perception that errors, and when we do make mistakes, that patients have poor outcomes? It's not like we're working at a bakery. Do you think that intolerance of error means that people are more hesitant to put their hand up when they make mistakes? We judge others because of that, and we don't have that culture of it's okay to fail sometimes, and you need to fail to grow. Like, I tell people, especially students, like, fail stands for first attempt in learning. Right? You don't come into paramedic school year one knowing how to be the perfect paramedic. You don't get a job as a chief executive being the perfect chief executive. Perfection isn't attainable. It is this illusion that will never be obtained. How do we tolerate mistakes and error?
Yeah, it's a great question, mate. I've actually never thought about whether the sort of nature or gravity of the consequence, i.e. some very serious patient outcome, has caused us to be very reluctant to share those mistakes. My instinct, though, is that it is more cultural than that. My instinct is that, you know, outdated historical notions of management and leadership focused on this idea that you were technically brilliant, so then you got promoted into these sort of senior roles, you know, and I think we've definitely seen that in the AMBOs across Australia, you know, these really great intensive care paramedics or critical care paramedics or whatever then got promoted to these management roles because they were really great at being a clinician on road. But that has at times fueled this idea that they must know everything and you mustn't, you know, you must know everything in order to be in a management role. And I got to say, like, sometimes the teams that I've been leading can be as unforgiving as your other managers. You know, you make a mistake or you don't have the answer to something and they can really whoop your ass for it. You know, I can't believe you didn't know that. You're supposed to be the manager. Even when I've been, you know, candid and said, look, I just don't know the answer to that. I'll have to go away and find that information for you. So, you know, I think you know, to come back to your question, I suspect that some of the consequences of the care we provide and errors in delivering that care does make it hard for people to share mistakes. But I also think there's a sort of strong cultural legacy around what it means to be a manager and what it means to be, frankly, a human being more broadly, and you know, how we attach notions of success to people who know everything, you know, and that might circle back to Sunny's earlier comments about, you know, all our measures of success being around intelligence, knowing lots of stuff, knowing everything, which really is misaligned with contemporary leadership, I think.
It's interesting because, you know, often management do things right according to the organization, whereas a leader will do the right thing. And sometimes doing the right thing means you're at the firing line. You know, you're talking about these people who are actually under you, ridiculing you for having enough emotional intelligence and vulnerability to say, "I don't know, let's work together." And I think I mean, this is the challenge of leadership and management, isn't it? How do you then encourage them to develop what they're missing, which is, you know, generally low levels of emotional intelligence, low levels of reflective practice. And often these people are actually hiding their own vulnerability by stomping on someone else's and shining a spotlight on it to make themselves, I guess, look taller. And I think, you know, we talk about we rise by lifting others, yet so often people are rising by standing on someone's shoulders and stomping.
You know, it comes back to Roosevelt's, Theodore Roosevelt's quote about the man in the arena or the person in the arena, you know, and the quote really talks about it not being the critic who counts, you know, but actually the person who's prepared to step into the arena, to make the difficult decisions, to take on the leadership role, to make mistakes, to fall short, to not be good enough at times, but who keeps coming back and giving it another go. And I think that, you know, as leaders, what's really important for us, I totally butchered Roosevelt's quote then, by the way, sorry about that.
That was great.
It's a hard one to remember, but, you know, I think just
throw us a statistic really quickly and people will forget it.
Yeah. but I think the thing is that that's why I think the obligation for me to speak and use my position of power as a chief executive is so important. And that's why I think that my responsibility to share the mistakes I make, which are often, and to talk about my own shortcomings and share my learnings and reflect on how I could do things better and do that in a public way, is really, it is a solemn obligation of mine. And I hope, maybe naively, I hope that it creates a culture and continues to create a culture where mistake and shortcoming and growth and reflection are seen as desirable, and in fact, always being right, always being smug, failing to take into account the opinions or views of others is actually seen as highly undesirable and counter to what we're trying to achieve in terms of our organizational culture at Ambulance TAS.
Oh, sorry, I was going to say it's interesting because we need to have competent leaders, so you don't want to have too many vulnerabilities, but we still do need them. Nick and I have even discussed some of our own clinical errors on this podcast quite openly and publicly, and it's been interesting even seeing the ridicule that we cop sometimes when we're openly sharing here. And, you know, we talk about mistakes, Nick. Last year, we'd actually scheduled Jordan to speak to us, the CEO of Ambulance Tasmania. We stood him up.
We did. We did. It helps if you put the appointments in the calendar.
Oh, we're quite grateful that you actually gave us a second go, Jordan. We were both laughing when we were online today saying, "I bet you he stands us up. Come on, we're going to go third time lucky."
Hey, nothing wrong with standing me up. It was a busy time of year and I appreciate you guys have lots of stuff going on as well.
It's not very often we get a chief executive or a commissioner on the podcast. So before we wrap up, we might throw a few quick questions at you, if that's right.
Go.
Can you fix ramping?
Yes. It requires the whole health system to be dialed in, but it's not. But when I say that, it's not an unachievable task. And in the coming months, Ambulance Tasmania, alongside the Department of Health and the Tasmanian Health Service, will go live with a mandated transfer of care protocol where all ambulances must be offloaded within 60 minutes.
Spicy. I like it.
We'll have to see. Hey,
and you know, we will likely see iterations of that in the future. But we know that if the system is all dialed in, if, you know, inpatient wards, the emergency department, outpatient services are all focused on flow, then you can achieve transfer of care.
It's one of those things that, you know, the strategy you're putting in place, no doubt there'll be critics of it, whether it has marginal success or a lot of success. But it's one of those things that small changes and small changes and small changes will eventually result in a large change. So it's a start of a journey. One thing I meant to ask you earlier, Jordan, I love these conversations. They go off in so many different directions. It's awesome. You did reference earlier 4 hang-ups, and I was just curious if you could just educate me really quickly on what you believe those were.
Yeah, sure. So I think the first cultural hang-up is this practice of shit canning, as I talked about. So the fairly regular act of dehumanizing people, and it starts really early in paramedicine. I think I talked about the PTOs being called potatoes. I also talked about, you know, this idea of, bonding over the mistreatment or dehumanizing of others. And, you know, you've seen examples of that where you guys have talked about making mistakes on this podcast, and then you have people mock you or humiliate you for doing that. It often, I think it's important to just flag that often comes down to these really kind of basic qualities about the individual, right? So the number of times people have told me throughout my career, I'm a young, entitled, you know, person who hasn't done my time, you know, or like I'm an entitled millennial or Gen Y, you know. I mean, firstly, I can't change the year I was born. Unfortunately, that's out of my control. And secondly, I can't change the generation in which I was born. So you can either dehumanize me, or you can say, gosh, you know, Jordan's a young, ambitious person. What are the great things that we can harness in him? And how can I learn from that? And how can I share my learnings with him? In the space of shit canning, I have a similar aversion to the comments like old white men. You know, I hear those comments thrown around, and, you know, they can't change their age, they can't change their race, and they can't change their biological sex. So why don't we focus on the things that are within their sphere of control rather than dehumanizing them for being old white men?
The irony of what dehumanizing people who care for people all through their shift are dehumanizing each other. The irony of that, this is a cultural hang up. You're spot on.
Yeah. And then so the other one is common enemy intimacy, which is really just shit canning in teams, right? It's where the teams get together and shit canning.
Say common enemy intimacy 5 times quickly. Go.
Common enemy intimacy, common enemy intimacy.
Faster.
It's good.
It's hard. It's
like a Dr. Seuss book.
But grouping up with people who hate the same people we do, and it's, you know, the opposite of true belonging. And the connections are based on kindredness around disconnection and isolation of another person, as Professor Brené Brown talks about.
Mm-hmm.
The third cultural hang-up, I think, is a really big one, and that's the idea of power over, not power with. And we see in our organizations this sort of disproportionate emphasis on command and control, on marks of rank, on notions of chain of command. And in power dynamics, it reinforces power over individuals. You know, it centralizes decision-making, pushes away notions of shared leadership, and says that I'm in charge because of my rank and I have power over you. And I think that gives rise to a whole gamut of cultural problems that we could spend another podcast talking about, except you probably wouldn't invite me back.
And that goes back to, you can either work with me or you can work for me. The irony of that is you can only use that approach as a leader and manager with the right staff, because there are some people who unfortunately do need to work for you that do need to be managed because of those, you know, lacking levels of EQ.
Yeah, and I think the thing is, you know, we like, it's not to say that command and control has no place, but I mean, we spend 99% of our time managing people in a people organization, and 1% of our time doing emergency management or sort of major incident management. Like, yes, we attend to emergency cases. Yes, we're providing emergency healthcare, but we can achieve everything we need to achieve through contemporary people leadership without having to have command and control over our individuals. We need that for the major bushfire or flood. We don't need that when we're running ambulance services across different jurisdictions in Australia, even if we're doing emergency work. Sorry, Adam.
I was going to say that was the statistic we needed earlier.
Yeah, yeah.
99 or
whatever. The final culture hang-up is the most controversial one, right? It's the one that I've had the most sort of pushback on, and that's this idea that we're an ambulance family. And I say to people, we're not a family. We're a team. And there's some really good evidence that setting organizational culture based around notions of family is actually harmful. And yet we still see this strong emphasis on the ambulance family, the blue family, the police family. And the problem with that is personal and professional lines begin to blur. And I've seen this very strong tendency to accept unacceptable behavior because we're all part of the family, and people don't want to report those concerns because, you know, they feel like it's a sense of betrayal. You know, we get this really exaggerated sense of loyalty. You know, our whole identity becomes being a paramedic and being with our ambulance brothers and sisters. And, you know, I think that creates this environment where reporting misconduct is difficult. We don't want to leave the organization, even when it's harmful for us to stay. And as I said, we make ambulance our whole identity. But one of the most important parts about the evidence in this space of, you know, the workplace family is it creates a power dynamic where employees are more prone to be taken advantage of by employers. So by leaders in organizations are more prone to exploit or take advantage of people where there's a strong culture of family and where they might be expected to do and say and act in such a way that is loyal to the family, to the organization, rather than actually to their professional obligations or to their best interests. And, you know, there's a funny quote that I just referenced in the presentation that I gave by a US author called Sue Grafton, where she says, people talk about dysfunctional families. I've never seen any other kind. I mean, some of the most dysfunctional relationships in our lives are with our own family members. And to sort of, yes, it's nice to talk about this idea. It gives us the sort of warm and fuzzy feeling when we talk about being an ambulance family, but actually it's really not helpful. We're a team united by a common purpose to deliver excellent care, the best care we can, to the people of Queensland or New South Wales or Tasmania or WA or wherever we're providing that service.
You know, Nick and I pride ourselves on taking a different approach to paramedic education and development. That's, you know, that's why we started the magazine. It's why we started the podcast. It's why we run our own CPD events, is because we like to say and do things that are just different. And in one fell swoop, you've managed to upset half of the ambulance family out there to finish up this podcast. And I love it.
Yeah. Yeah. Look, you know, I see why people think it's a really romantic notion. And I'd really challenge people to think of it differently, because it's beautiful when some tragic event happens and we all rally together. But that can be achieved just as easily by being a really strong, united team. And I think if you look broadly across the research, which is not all that well developed in ambulance, but it's reasonable across other organizations, we can see that these strong notions of family within workplaces actually give rise to a lot of challenges in terms of organizational culture.
Jordan, thank you so much for coming on the podcast today, mate. Really appreciate your time.
It's a pleasure. Hey, it's been a great discussion. I appreciate you hearing my musings on culture.
That's great. I loved it. Sonny, always a pleasure.
As is indeed. Hey, did you hear something about New Year's and Jordan being out on the street?
Yeah, did you do a night shift? Excuse
yeah,
me.
I did work on road, but I didn't do a full night shift. I don't want to be a lying bastard.
but you were out on the street on New Year.
Yeah,
CEO.
I worked till about 3:30 in the morning with my colleague Tim McCready's, who actually hails from QAS. But we went out and, you know, it was very New Year's Eve-esque. You know, we went to patients affected by alcohol and drugs and a few punch-ups and, yeah.
Excellent.
That's unreal. That is unreal. Nick, thanks so much. This has certainly been a powerful discussion for me. Jordan, thank you so much.
Thanks, Jordan.
Thanks, gents.
If you have any questions, qualms, queries, or concerns, we got a question for Jordan. Reach out to us. You can find us on Facebook. Send us an email. Or head to our website, www.theshiftextension.org. See you later.